Today's Dead Idea. This is part 6 of our series on Titoism, and today we're talking about art, pop, and Yugo-nostalgia. Basically everything that made Yugoslavia defy all stereotypical expectations for a communist country. And to help us understand artistic freedom under Tito, we have a very special interview today with Dr. Noah Charney of the University of Ljubljana. That's what we're talking about today on Dead Ideas. Imagine, if you will, your typical communist worker, the average rank-and-file citizen in a communist state. I mean, what does that look like? Maybe you imagine something like a factory worker in drab clothes, living in a concrete apartment building, all of it very austere and unflashy, with, private moments maybe spent with your family, or maybe playing some kind of traditional folk music, or I don't know what. Everything, though, done in service of the state. Well, today we're going to dive into the cultural life of the people of Tito's communist Yugoslavia, and we'll discover that it was really not as you might think. We're going to be talking today about things that bring to life the people of Yugoslavia, their art, their music, their pop culture. And our main interview for today is Dr. Noah Charney, an American expat who lives and works in Slovenia today. Noah is going to talk to us about art and artistic freedom. Then we are going to talk about pop culture and hear a little more from our old friend Srđan Perišić from the last episode. And then finally we'll talk with both Noah and Srđan, who will give us their firsthand experiences of today's phenomenon of Yugo-nostalgia, which looks back on Tito's regime with a certain wistful longing. And our time period today is going to flow back and forth rather freely between the Tito and post-Tito eras, so just to keep the timeline straight, it'll be helpful to remember that Tito died in 1980, but Yugoslavia stayed intact until 1990, so basically anything in the 80s is post-Tito, but still Titoism, or rather the last gasps of it. Alright, so let's get to our main interview for today. Thanks for being on the show, Noah.
Thank you for having me.
Noah Charney is an adjunct professor of art history at the University of Ljubljana, among other things. He specializes in art crime, and his first novel, The Art Thief, is a bestseller in 5 countries. He is also a founding editor of Versopolis, the European Review of Poetry, Books, and Culture, and he actually approached me about writing an article for the review about Dead Ideas and Titoism, and I said sure, but to be honest, I was even more excited at the idea of finding out from a PhD in art history what it was like in Tito's time when it came to artistic expression. So Noah's going to help us with that today. And then I'm going to go into pop culture, and we'll talk about Yugo-nostalgia and so on. And by the way, everybody, I have to insert here that Noah definitely wins the award for being the best trooper in doing this interview, because I got to tell you, like, everything that could have gone wrong went wrong with this. I mean, we had time zone issues. The audio was really not good, so he actually had to re-record his part of the conversation on his own. So if it sounds like our conversation is just off somehow, a little bit unnatural, that's why. So I hope you can just forgive that, because for him to be here talking to us, like, he really put in double time in terms of effort here. So thank you again to Noah for doing this interview. All right, here we go. All right, Noah, let's start off with an overriding question for today, and you can give some initial thoughts, and then we'll circle back to this question at the end. So my question is, was there any such thing as artistic freedom under Tito? Yes, no, or it's complicated?
The answer is yes, plus it's complicated. As with many things under Tito's regime, there was an unusually high level of freedom when compared to other socialist governments. And it was always provided that you were doing something that did not feel like it was engaging in politics. So artistic freedom and expression in terms of format, the sort of things that you talked about, were fine provided it was not a negative commentary on the regime in question and Tito in particular. And it certainly couldn't appear to be pro-fascist, which was the ultimate enemy from Tito's perspective. Otherwise, it was quite open.
Okay, so in other words, there were very particular topics that were off limits, but then beyond that, there wasn't really a whole lot of censorship going on?
That's correct. And you get some very beautiful films that were made that you might think would be rough issues, topics like World War II. But in fact, pro-partisan films were extremely popular and quite good. You get films that are very artistic, that imply some sort of socio-political commentary, but they couldn't do so overtly. And provided they weren't speaking directly against the regime and against Tito, then what you were doing as an artist, that was quite flexible. But it also had to do with your location. Yugoslavia is such an enormous country, and in fact, it's an assemblage of different countries with very different agendas and practice. For instance, Slovenia, which was always the most economically and culturally independent and advanced of the former Yugoslav states, there was really a great deal more freedom than perhaps you might imagine if you were comparing it to maybe making a film in Belgrade.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Interesting. So what kinds of art were created in Tito's regime? I mean, was it all the kinds that we would expect, say, in America, or were there particular kinds that were really big in Yugoslavia, like painting in particular, or film or something? Or what did they create in terms of art in Tito's Yugoslavia?
Well, throughout the socialist bloc, particularly Russia and its satellites, social realism was what was promoted primarily. This is after the revolution, and this was celebrated just last year, in fact, in a bunch of high-profile exhibits in museums like the Royal Academy of Arts in London. The art of the Russian Revolution was initially very flexible, and abstraction was welcomed, minimalism too. But then state-sanctioned, and particularly Stalin-influenced, power struggles came into play. And Stalin was for this social realism, which is essentially photorealistic paintings and naturalistic sculptures. And by naturalistic, I mean they look like real life. They're not abstract, they're not minimalist. And they were meant to empower the working class and show them in a heroic light. This is the easiest sort of art to understand. You don't need any special background. You can appreciate a work of art as having been well done if it looks like real life. That's the most basic format. It's totally unintellectual, and there's very easy to understand message that the working class are the heroes of our nation and should be celebrated.
Huh. All right. Okay. So I wonder then if that changed after the Tito-Stalin split, though.
That's a very good question. Artistically, Tito essentially wasn't particularly interested in the arts, full stop. He had his hands full with the politics table. His pastimes were lavish meals, socializing, and hunting, so art wasn't high on his priority list. So I think that I mean, you see, social realist style art in former Yugoslavia, and that was still state-sanctioned, and that's what was taught at art academies during the Socialist Republic of Yugoslavia. If you look around at any of the former Yugoslav countries today, you can see Yugoslav-era monuments which are either brutalist, which may be a bit more avant-garde, and that was about as abstract as monuments got. And you can see these sort of structures in this former Soviet Union as well. But most of them there look naturalistic. They're sculptures of partisans or factory workers in heroic poses, and they look like real life, and relatively little in terms of abstraction. Some of them get a bit cubist, but that's about as exciting as it gets.
Hmm. Yeah, I've seen pictures of some of these brutalist monuments, and there's some on our website too. And I have to say, they look pretty darn abstract. They actually look like something from an alien planet on Star Trek or something to me. It's crazy.
Just yesterday, I was in a town called Ilirska Bistrica, and there's something called the Hill of Freedom, and it's an absolutely amazing sort of brutalist but organic monument made of poured concrete that is really, it's beautiful, it's worth Googling. It's the kind of thing that's the best example of what they were doing in Yugoslavia. The important thing to keep in mind is anyone could do whatever sort of art they wanted to at home. So the real question was what was being displayed, what was for public consumption. And throughout socialism, whatever you were doing that you were expected or hoped to be paid for, or which was commissioned by the state, of course it had to meet the state's expectations of what you would produce. So there's a basic dichotomy. There are people producing art in all sorts of ways, but they're doing it for themselves, for private use, or maybe for a sort of guerrilla exhibition. And then there's the state-sanctioned, high-visibility works of art that you could actually get paid for that are of a certain style, and they're censored, but really, To be honest, it doesn't make sense to bite the hand that feeds you and to be receiving state funds or an important state commission and then produce something that you have a feeling will not be met well. It just doesn't make sense and wasn't something that was done. So it's a sort of self-selecting group if you're creating art. And even if the materials through which you are working are provided for you by the state and the state is looking over your shoulder throughout, well, it's illogical to play with fate and develop something that the state is not going to like with state funding.
Yeah, that makes sense. But it also leads me into something that I wanted to ask, which was, were there things that could not be expressed under Tito? I mean, you mentioned a few, but maybe those things were still expressed, but just hidden behind like veiled allusions and references and things like that. I mean, for example, if you look at Spanish cinema under Franco, I mean, you have surrealist things where some of the messages that were perhaps anti-regime were sort of coded or symbolic within the surrealism of the piece, you know, so it flew under the radar of the censors to some extent. Was there anything like that going on?
Yeah, there were some instances of things like that, and I'm just trying to pull out an example. Actually, I have a book in front of me that I've bookmarked for this, and there are some examples inside. But the most famous examples are from what is probably the most famous art group to come out of the former Yugoslavia, the Irwin Group, which is also, just to confuse you, it's got a couple of names and incarnations. The same group of people are also involved in NSK, and a group of five friends who are Slovenian founded this. They also initially founded a group called Leibach, which began as a sort of performance art music group, and now with some new members is a very popular performance art slash heavy metal rock band. The person in the group I'm particularly friendly with is a guy named Roman Uraniek, and he was working with these guys starting in the late 80s. They began as essentially a performance art group with multiple wings. So Leibach was the music wing, their music department, and NSK was their sort of activist conceptual art department. NSK has an interesting story because when they first began, they were creating things on their own. They didn't receive state funding, and they also got into some trouble. On one occasion in particular, they produced a poster that was a mock fascist era poster, but the authorities weren't sure if it was mocking it or promoting it. They actually were called to Belgrade on trial, and there was a danger that they could go to prison, but they were able to argue their point that they were mocking the fascist aesthetic rather than endorsing it. So sometimes irony or subtlety may be lost on a social apparatus or the authorities in the building of some ministry somewhere. In this case, they narrowly escaped. And Roman, one of the members of the Irwin group, talks about that as being the highest tension moment for them. That could have got them on a blacklist as a political potential troublemaker.
Ah, yes, yes, yes. I am so glad that you talked about that. And Leibach is actually something that I've discovered in NSK too, in my research for this. But Leibach was formed in 1980, the same year Tito died, and NSK came after the formation of Leibach, I believe. So this is basically getting into the decade right after Tito, correct?
That's right, yeah. It was not much of a shift in terms of approach to the arts with Tito's death. Frankly, there were too many other things to worry about, so the arts were supported in a more passive way during his regime, particularly things like film, which was considered something that could be exported and show particularly Western audiences that Yugoslavia is really quite wonderful and was not dark and dismal and was quite different from the idea of Russia. Fiction, literature, poetry, these were reasonably supported, and I want to say music was for domestic consumption, but film for foreign consumption. That was really the focal point because film was the easiest export.
I never thought about that part. Okay, yeah. Yeah, I saw on YouTube a post-Tito travel documentary from the 80s that was like, come to Yugoslavia, it's not what you think. We have wine and women in bikinis.
Yes, and it really was like that. This is one of the things that you realize quickly when you speak to people who are here, particularly where I am in Slovenia, which always had the best of what Yugoslavia had to offer. And we're going towards independence and free open borders and whatnot, even during Yugoslavia. So you could cross the border to go shopping. It really wasn't a problem. Slovenia had basically the best incarnation of socialism of any experiment with socialism in the world. It was the best place to be in Yugoslavia, and Yugoslavia was the most successful version of socialism of any socialist state. It was the least repressive, the most open, the most egalitarian in reality, whereas elsewhere there would be, you know, bread lines for 99% of the people, and then some people who were members of the party had no trouble getting what they needed. It wasn't completely equal in Yugoslavia, of course, but it was more so. And people were more content than elsewhere in the former socialist countries. And within Yugoslavia, Slovenia always essentially functioned independently within the larger context.
Yeah, and that's something that we've gone into in this series in fair detail, actually. But it's good to hear that message reinforced, and, you know, to know that I guess I got it right. But yeah, that's interesting.
The other important artist from a more abstract and art historical standpoint who grew up in Yugoslavia was Marina Abramović, who is perhaps the most famous conceptual artist alive at the moment. And she began performing in Belgrade. She was from a very influential family, which probably helped to protect her. But the sort of things she did, she got away with things even during socialist times that would surprise you. For instance, she had a famous performance in, I think it was in Zagreb, where she made a pentagram in a public square with sawdust and lighter fuel, and she set it on fire, so that she was standing in the middle of this giant flaming pentagram, which the red star is the symbol of Yugoslavia, of course, a red pentagram. And she was standing in it, and she hadn't quite realized that oxygen would be in short supply because of the flames around her, and she had to be rescued. That was one of her performances that did not get her into trouble, surprisingly. And I think it was a proactive attempt to not be repressive and to let people let off steam in that she was not persecuted for having done this performance, which you could imagine might be objectionable. So provided it wasn't an attack on the regime, it was okay to do this sort of thing. And that's about as close as a performance could get to being interpreted as negative commentary on the regime, but managing to get away without any severe consequences.
Wow. Yeah, you definitely do not think of that sort of expression going on under any kind of communist state, you know, stereotypically at least.
I think a lot of this has to do with, and I'm not sure if this is conscious, but during the Roman Empire, there was an amazing, aside from a couple crackdown periods during the reigns of emperors Domitian and Nero, well, there was a very flexible approach to religion within the Roman Empire. You could practice any religion you want, provided it did not get political. The reason that Christ was executed was because he was claiming to be king of the Jews. At least that was the rationale put forward. It was no problem with him thinking he was the Jewish Messiah. Nobody was going to object to that. It was when he became political, and his enemies said that he was calling himself the king of the Jews, that all of a sudden it became a problem. There were a lot of people walking around and claiming that they were the Messiah and not getting into trouble. There was even someone else who lived roughly at the same time of Jesus of Nazareth, who was also named Jesus, which was a very common name back then, who thought he was the Jewish Messiah, and who was also crucified. The issue was, if someone began to get politically active or gather a group of followers that could lead to an uprising, that was really the main focal point of concern. What you believed and practiced at home in private was really very open during the Roman Empire. So it was similar under socialist Yugoslavia. Creating art, as long as it didn't get political, well, you could do what you would like. There was room for letting off steam and self-expression that was actually beneficial. But the problem was, if you wanted to go public, if you wanted state sponsorship, if you wanted to have an official exhibition, then you had to toe the line more.
Yeah, very interesting analogy. Okay, so I want to move on to the next question. And the next thing I want to ask, and this isn't something that I would normally even have thought to ask, but I know that your area of expertise is art crime. So was there anything interesting going on in terms of art crime under Tito?
There was. I think the most interesting thing and what surprised me is maybe not categorized the way you're thinking in terms of art theft or forgery. But after the Second World War, Nazi officers preferred to occupy castles when they took over territories. And that was the same case when they were occupying what would become Yugoslavia, once they were kicked out of the territories. So once the Nazis were kicked out of the territories, the partisans occupied the castles. But only briefly. One of the great tragedies was that these castles were in huge numbers. There were dozens of them, very beautiful, full of art. And first they were looted by the partisans in informal ways, which is unfortunate but understandable. If you're fighting for survival, you try to gather whatever supplies you can. If they had been looted in a more formal way, then that actually would have been better, because it would have been easier to recover the object or objects, or at least to know what was missing. But in this case, it was informally looted, and then many of the castles, unfortunately, were burned. They were burned by the partisans for no good reason other than that they objected to the aristocratic implications of these castles, which for centuries had been the posts of nobility, and this was largely an imported Habsburg nobility ruling over the people in a feudal manner, so this was a classist issue. And these were incredibly beautiful castles, which survived sometimes in black and white photos, sometimes in old prints, and dozens of them. I mean, where I live in Slovenia, just north of Ljubljana, there were around 11 castles that were here until the end of the Second World War and were destroyed for no good reason except an ideological one. And it's a very great shame, of course. That's something that surprised me because the castles were full of art, which may or may not have been destroyed along with them. It was probably looted and much of it dispersed, but then the castles themselves were destroyed.
Interesting. Yeah. So art, not art crime in the way that you would think normally, but almost more like the Taliban destroying ancient Buddhist monuments or stuff like that, a kind of almost ideological kind of art crime.
Yeah, when I teach the history of art crime, there are five categories we look at. We have art theft, which is theft of objects from extant collections. We have illicit trade and looting of antiquities, which is taking objects directly from the earth or sometimes the sea that have not existed in collections before. We have fakes and forgeries, we have war looting, and we have vandalism and iconoclasm. And so this that I mentioned covers two of those categories. We have war looting, which is usually institutionalized and legal in the regime currently in power. And then there's iconoclasm, which is the symbolic destruction of art or monuments. So this looting and then destruction of castles combines two of the five categories of art crime, although when most people think of art crime, they think just of forgery or theft from museums.
Wow, okay. Again, something that I never would have even thought of before this. So in the end, to recap our conversation then, so our question was there any such thing as artistic freedom under Tito? And it definitely sounds like the answer is it's complicated, and we get a lot of nuance of what that meant. I mean, free as long as you didn't criticize the regime. And I think your analogy of the Roman Empire really kind of highlighted that. So were there any concluding thoughts on that question that you wanted to add?
I think really throughout Yugoslavia, for Westerners, there was a surprising amount of freedom and contentedness. I think that's one of the key things that most people don't realize that surprises them, which to me speaks to the fact that there is a Yugo nostalgia. From our perspective at home, people did whatever they liked, but if they wanted to go public with it, then quite largely it had to be within a certain context that was state accepted. So there wasn't much room for leaving a legacy that is particularly revolutionary. But it is a legacy of art all the same. It might not be the most exciting, but it is interesting as a historical time capsule.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you for that, Noah. Folks, we're going to hear more from Noah at the end of this episode. Now we are going to switch to Yugoslav pop culture, which, like that travel documentary suggests, you know, with the wine and the women in the bikinis, like, come to Yugoslavia, it's not what you think. And that was true. I mean, it really wasn't, at least not for a typical communist state. And I'll put that documentary, I'll be embedded in our episode post. And we also have lots of other pop culture images for you as well, which you can look at while you listen to this, including Yugoslav cinema posters, advertising, and even a Yugoslav nudie mag cover from the 60s. So definitely check that out. So yeah, Yugoslav pop culture, very different from what you think. So first now, I'm going to let our friend Srđan Perišić give you his first-hand impressions of pop culture in the Tito and post-Tito eras. And then after that, I'm going to fill in some of the gaps and explain why it was so different and how Yugoslavia had hippies and even punks under Tito.
What can you tell me about pop culture in Yugoslavia while Tito was alive? I mean, Yugoslavia had its own rock bands. It had its own cinema. It had a lot of things that we wouldn't normally stereotypically think of going on freely in a communist country.
Absolutely, and that's another piece what this communist country, Yugoslavia, was different than any from other communist country. Yeah, we had the rock bands, we had discos, and I remember Flashdance, when the breakdance, breakdance that came out was 80s. And that was popular. We had our rock bands, I'm still going and online and Googling it and listen to that music from from 70s and 80s. And some of these folks are actually very good, and you can, you know, do research on them, and Goran Bregovic and but what became very interesting is Emir Kusturica with his movies as well. So, but what I found very interesting is that they came up with their own type of music, but called turbo folk.
Turbo folk,
which is kind of country music, but turbo style, which is like a techno trance country music. So that's who came as a after the rock and roll, and really we had a heavy metal bands, and all of a sudden that started merging toward this turbo folk, which became extremely, extremely popular between a trance, a rave, and there is a country music in it. It's bizarre. So we had a pretty much everything. Movies were also censored what you could watch. Mm-hmm. Was a lot of partisans movies and movies that from United States, but more that is geared towards the war and alliance with the United States and beating Germans and beating Italians and so forth. So not that we weren't limited, but certainly we didn't have a full range. Mm-hmm. Of let's go and see whatever we want to see. Mm-hmm. It's, again, you're being fed what you can see, what you cannot see. But a music, again, rock and roll, heavy metal, again, we had a break dance, but that was also limited. You couldn't use the language, foul language or anything like that. So you got to kind of be careful what you sing.
Were you able to see Star Wars in the 1970s? Did you have Western movies?
I can't recall. I don't think so. Uh-huh. I can't recall.
Okay. Yeah.
I do recall watching a Godfather.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. So you had some Western movies.
Godfather was early 70s, right? 1972, something 71. The first one.
Okay.
Was it? And I remember watching that. I think I was 14 or 15 years old.
And that wasn't something you had to sneak?
No. You could go to the theater. Mm-hmm. I remember having we didn't have so many theaters, only one theater, and good luck if you find the tickets. And if you do, then that movie would run for days. So as many people can see it. The Star Wars, I can't remember. I know I watched Star Wars, but I don't remember when.
What about, so that's a little bit about Western culture. What about Eastern culture? Were you able to see Soviet things? Or was it forbidden? Or was it just nobody would want to?
nobody really watched it. Okay. I think after the breakup between Stalin and Tito, that relationship never really healed, if you wish.
Sure.
You know, Tito called this his line. He wanted to be neutral between the East and West. But I don't think there any Russian or Warsaw Pact countries we had any influence to go to, because I could travel Western Europe, but I couldn't travel Eastern Europe because they were so tightly closed that you couldn't enter, you couldn't visit. Everything was censored. If you would go, you would go in the groups. You couldn't just backpack and I go and explore on my own.
Sure.
So that's why kind of by them doing that, they isolated themselves from us, if you wish.
Sure. Sure. So it wasn't necessarily that it was like outlawed or anything to watch, say, a Soviet movie, but it was difficult to get and you might not want to anyway.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you. And I know what I'm going to be YouTubing tonight. I'm going to be looking up Turbo Folk.
Oh, yeah, Turbo Folk.
Yeah.
Folk.
Yeah.
You will see that it's like a folk, but the folk music, like a country music, and then really like it's a techno trance, fast rhythm. Uh-huh. You're going to have a blast. But also, if you have a moment, look at the Goran Bregović.
Okay.
Goran Bregović, G-O-R-A-N-N-A-N, which is Goran Bregović. He had the most famous rock and roll band in Yugoslavia called Bijelo Dugme, which is white buttons. And he is someone who actually was obsessed with the gypsy music.
Okay.
A local gypsy music. And actually he involved the orchestra, Belgrade Philharmonic Orchestra, to produce that gypsy music in Philharmonic style. It's something you would definitely love it. And he also worked with, he recently died. Oh my God, I forgot his name. Iggy Pop.
Oh yeah. Okay.
He worked with Iggy Pop as well. No, actually, check it out. You're going to love it.
Awesome.
It's a gypsy music, and it's kind of interesting style.
Awesome.
So there's a firsthand account for you of pop culture in the Tito and post-Tito eras. Serjan emphasizes most of all the music, and will embed some of those videos, such as Bijelo Dugme and some Turbo Folk for you on our episode post. So now I want to ask, why was Yugoslavia different in terms of pop culture compared to pretty much any other communist state? Well, basically, at first it wasn't that different. I mean, right after World War II, it was very much closed to quote-unquote decadent Western influences. But after the Tito-Stalin split and the embargo against trade with Yugoslavia by pretty much any Eastern Bloc country, there was really only one place to turn to, and that was the West. So Western influences started to flood in, and it wasn't a completely free flow of goods and products into Yugoslavia. I mean, you could go shopping in Italy, in Trieste, but there are also lots of stories of having to hide or smuggle some of the things that you bought there when you were coming across the border back into Yugoslavia. And honestly, I couldn't find exactly which products they were that you had to smuggle back in, or even if it was specifically because they were banned or just because you didn't want to pay some high duties on them or something like that. I'm afraid I just couldn't find the answer to that. But you did have to be a little careful in what you brought back into the country. So in any case, there were some controls on inflow of Western culture, but basically you just couldn't stop it from coming in. It came right in anyway. And also, as we mentioned in an earlier episode, in terms of music, that fit this pattern too. Some kinds of music were off limits from the start. Jazz was at first banned, for example. Then later the ban on jazz was lifted, but boogie woogie was still no boogie woogie. But then even boogie woogie was okay. And eventually Western culture was basically allowed to flow in without much effort to staunch it. Or if there was any effort, it wasn't very effective. So now I'm going to go to a Slovenian sociologist and early punk rocker named Gregor Tomps. That's right, he actually founded the first punk band in Slovenia. But he's also a sociologist and wrote an article called A Tale of Two Subcultures that I'm going to be drawing from here. Gregor Tomps highlights several reasons why Western culture was allowed into communist Yugoslavia. And the first one is the Tito-Stalin split, as I just mentioned, which basically cut off access to Eastern goods and made the West the only real alternative. But the second reason was Tito's own bourgeois, quote-unquote, tastes. I mean, Tito was never that big on the whole stark, ascetic, socialist worker ideal that I started this episode with. He was always much more of a bon vivant and a hedonist, and he enjoyed life. And remember, he was a lover of fine suits and cigars, and he maintained extravagant villas throughout the country. And all of this combined to kind of make it seem okay, more or less, to indulge in consumerism for the average person, even in a communist state. And also, people had easy access to credit, and they could hop across the border to Trieste in Italy for shopping trips, And long story short, Yugoslavia basically became a unique hybrid culture of Eastern and Western influences, resulting in the kind of place that, like the travel documentary suggests, is not what you think. I mean, you could say that Yugoslavia basically became an oxymoron of sorts, a state of communist consumerism. Now, the hippie movement, as it manifested in Yugoslavia, actually took aim at that very consumerism in the 60s and 70s. And one young poet of that generation wrote a song which was entitled "Ideals Are Cheaper in Trieste." Trieste was the shopping place in Italy, right? Meanwhile, at the same time, the hippie movement in Yugoslavia was also political, so very similar to the hippie movement all over the world, and kind of just underscoring that it wasn't just some localized thing cut off and, you know, lagging behind. It was very much a part of the world culture of the hippie movement. It was, you know, taking full part just the same way people in any other country were. So hippies in Yugoslavia, for example, hippie students made trade unionist demands for cheaper dormitory rents, demonstrated in favor of the rights of Slovenian minorities in Austria, and protested against the visit of President Nixon to Yugoslavia and the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. And those are just some local issues that were of concern to them. But they also protested things that hippies all over the world were protesting, like the Vietnam War. They did that in Yugoslavia too. And Gregor Tomps writes that hippie students, quote, supported the socialist project in principle, but the problem was that they were more radical than the party elite. And a well-known student slogan at the time, which illustrates this problem, was "For communism against communism." So Tomps here is highlighting that it was part of the world movement, but it also had this local inflection. You know, the Yugoslav hippies were pro-communism, but even more radical in terms of the progressiveness and social welfare aspect of it, it sounds like. So it had its own local flair as well. Meanwhile, another youth movement, of which Gregor Tomps was an integral part, was the budding punk movement, which appeared in Yugoslavia in the mid-1970s, about the same time as their English counterparts. And Tomps tells how Slovenian punk began with the formation of his band named Pankriti. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but it means bastards, which at first seemed to have no future. They like played a show or two and then seemed to go nowhere, but apparently it struck a chord with the youth. And now I'm going to let him tell the rest of the story in his own words here. This is quoting from his article, A Tale of Two Subcultures. Gradually, a whole punk subculture evolved, a homology of creativity and everyday life. On the one hand, there were other bands besides Pankriti, like Ljubljanski Tsi, Ljubljana Dogs, Kutzle, Bitches, Berlinski Zid, Berlin Wall, and Group 92, in the first wave of bands, as well as punk discos, fanzines, and graffiti. On the other hand, there was a punk lifestyle appearing publicly, perhaps for the first time on such a scale, image, slang, values. During the first couple of years, this subculture was perceived by representatives of the dominant culture only as a symbolic threat. Persecution of the subculture began in earnest when F. Popit, then at the top of the party elite, decided that punks publicly vomiting on socialism should be stopped. The authoritarian leader clarified the party position on punk. This was the sign police needed to start with its repression. Now, I have to imagine that this is exactly what the punks themselves were craving. I mean, the whole spirit and energy of punk is anti-establishment, right? So if the establishment cracks down on you, it almost gives you an opportunity to be exactly what you always wanted to be. So I have to imagine that this early repression probably almost fed the punk movement in Slovenia and probably swelled its numbers, I would have to imagine. Tomps continues, there were raids on pubs and other meeting places, police violence against punks on streets, raids against graffiti writers, concerts banned, and censorship became more strict. And then, now after this, Tomps goes into something that almost reminds me of kind of like the Satanic Scare or something in the 1980s, but with a Yugoslav flavor to it. Remember, in Tito's Yugoslavia, the worst thing you could possibly be was a fascist. So, Tomps continues. The persecution of the punk image became more common. A favorite target of policemen were badges with swastikas and, quote, "Nazi punks fuck off," unquote, written over them. This repression gradually escalated into the so-called Nazi punk affair. Now, I'm not sure if I'm reading this right, but it sounds to me like the punks were wearing badges that had swastikas written with "Nazi punks fuck off," as if the punks wearing these badges were against Nazis, or against other punks that were Nazi punks or something. But it seems like, in the eyes of the authorities here, they're all getting lumped together as Nazi punks. If I'm reading that right, that's what it sounds like to me. So, he continues, a populist weekly newspaper, with the help of police informers, connected two otherwise completely separate events. Some swastika graffiti appeared in Ljubljana, concerts or Goebbels assemblies, the journalist wondered, and some pupils maltreated a classmate who planted these 17-year-old kids on us, the journalist added. The answer was obvious to him, Nazi punks. So sensationalism in the media, just like that 1980s Satanic Scare, creates apparently this image in the public mind, in the media, in the police authorities, that there's Nazism arising among this weird, strange young punk movement, when it sounds like, in fact, there may not have been at all, just like there really wasn't very much going on in the 80s in America for Satanism. So, very interesting. All right, Tomps concludes, a moral panic was created and spread across Slovenia's borders. The consensus among Yugoslav media was that there is no place for punk in a socialist society. Subsequently, three punks were arrested in Ljubljana and charged with secretly trying to organize a National Socialist Party of Slovenia. In the ensuing trial, all charges against the suspects were dropped, but by then the damage had been done. The punk subculture was perceived by communist authorities as a real threat to socialism and was by and large forced from everyday life to withdraw into more private and exclusively artistic punk scenes. And Tomps goes on later in the article to explain how in the West, the consumerist culture was able to kind of take punk fashion and assimilate it and kind of put it on display and almost make it kind of mainstream. And in that way, punk became a bigger, if diluted, kind of phenomenon in Western culture. But because of this early repression in Yugoslavia, it didn't achieve that. It stayed small, but I have to imagine it probably burned brighter and was less diluted in terms of its original kind of energy and ideals in Yugoslavia. So very interesting to me. So that's a little bit about punk in Yugoslavia. I mean, who ever thinks of punk in a communist state? I mean, maybe it's just my American stereotypical prejudices, but that just blows me away. And what interests me most about how these movements, the hippie movement, the punk movement, and everything else, what interests me most about them is how it brings to life the inner life of the people in Tito's Yugoslavia. I mean, when you see their counterculture movements and their discontent and dissent and deviancies kind of put on display, it shows you what's underneath, you know, underneath the facade, underneath the mask that is put on to, you know, please the authorities. And no, these don't represent the majority of the people in Tito's Yugoslavia, by no means, but represents something that's underneath the mask. And to me, that really just brings to life. It brings to life the culture and the people. So that's a little bit about that. Now, in the decade after Tito's death, things slid consistently downward for the country, and the pop culture betrayed this decline, basically just bursting at the seams with more of this discontent. So Tito died in 1980, and that very same year saw the formation of the band Laibach, which we mentioned before. And Laibach was the musical wing of the NSK art movement that Noah was talking about. And now, the name Laibach, see, Laibach is the German name for the city Ljubljana, the capital of Slovenia, and it was the name by which that city went during the Nazi occupation, and it was forbidden to call the city that during all of Tito's regime. So for them to adopt this name as their band name was quite a countercultural and transgressive move. So that's Laibach, and Laibach's music, if you listen to it, is extremely martial in spirit, and it just makes you feel like you're, you know, marching in step with soldiers or something. And that's quite intentional, because what they do with their whole aesthetic is they're trying to put on this mock fascist kind of, you know, image, with the not so subtle intention of putting on display the uncomfortable resemblances between the Titoist regime and its very arch enemy, fascism. And because of this kind of very controversial move, Laibach actually found itself banned in Slovenia and ended up spending far more time and playing far more shows outside Yugoslavia than in it. It's still active today, and actually recently it had the peculiar privilege of being the first rock band ever to play in North Korea. And they actually made a documentary about it, which you can watch, and it's extremely awkward. And it mostly shows the North Koreans in the audience kind of holding their ears, holding shut their ears to this weird music. But that happened. It was very strange. And John Oliver actually did a hilarious segment on this, which you can find easily on YouTube. It's pretty funny. You should watch it. So that brings us all the way up to the present. So now the last thing that I want to talk about is the phenomenon today known as Yugo-nostalgia. And here we'll talk to Noah again to get his impressions of this phenomenon as he sees it living in Slovenia today. So Noah, you're living in Slovenia today. What is it like there in terms of Yugo-nostalgia? I mean, I've read, for example, that you can walk down the street and they'll be selling like little tchotchkes and trinkets and things with Tito's image on them. I mean, you can walk into a cafe and you've got like sugar packets with Tito's face on them, all kinds of things. And that's kind of weird because, you know, Tito was a dictator. And you can imagine walking into a coffee shop that has like a Hitler sugar packet, and that would be considerably stranger. But it seems like it's basically part of life in Slovenia today. And I know that during the time when Tito was alive, it was very common to have these images of Tito up on your wall in your house or at your place of business, and that was just part of the culture. But now it's kind of something different. I mean, there's nobody's enforcing that, and it's not part of the current culture anymore. This is something different. This is like a looking back on it with this kind of wistfulness, almost like those were the good old days. So what does that seem like to you living in Slovenia today?
Well, it depends who you ask, and people are still really divided about whether they felt like they had it, if not better, then at least easier in Yugoslavia. And these days, politics is very much geared to who is a former socialist and who is a liberal and progressive. I think on a daily basis, if you just stop people in the street, you get the same basic response. Tito was absolutely universally beloved, that's a full stop, among his people, in a way that other dictators were not. He was a dictator, but people also appreciated the fact that thanks to his ingenuity, Yugoslavia functioned as a country successfully for many decades. And as soon as he died, and he was aware that this would happen, it was going to fall apart. It was inevitable. There were too many hostile forces. There were simply too many minority groups that were at each other's throats. And it was only through his force of will, this extraordinary human being, that Yugoslavia functioned. And not only functioned, but was actually a major player in world power, especially through the non-alignment movement. He was absolutely a remarkable figure, and Westerners probably know too little about him. He was just as big a figure as Churchill, Hitler, Stalin, FDR, but he gets less publicity. The fact that he was so universally beloved means that there are lots of remnants of him that are purchased these days, sometimes out of pride, sometimes out of irony, sometimes because it's kind of cool the way you might go to the Soviet Union and get a souvenir of a little Lenin statue or a little Mao head in China. But you can still find bars that have pictures of Tito on the wall. And of course, well, he was responsible for killing and imprisoning tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of his own people. No one's sure of the exact statistics, but he's up there with the really bad dictators for fatalities for his own people. But that's glossed over, and to be honest, if you look with an attempted objectivity historically, he did what he had to do to maintain the balance and to prevent Yugoslavia from collapsing into civil war, which was what would happen as soon as he died. Lots of people died, that's horrible, but I don't think you could find a dictator who didn't have some scent of that about him. It doesn't apologize for it, but it explains it.
Huh. Well, very cool. Folks, there you go. That's Yugo nostalgia from someone experiencing it firsthand in Slovenia today. I actually asked Srđan Perisic about this too, so let's hear from him again, one last time. Here's what he said about Yugo nostalgia.
So nowadays, there's something that I've read referred to as Yugo nostalgia, or even Titostalgia. Can you say anything about that?
Yeah, sure. Actually, that still exist. When I go back to Montenegro and talk to even my father, and he said my father was in his 80s now, and he says this is not what we fought for, right? Mm. It's in all of these countries of former Yugoslavia, right now all of them independent, even Kosovo. Mm-hmm. It's the first stage of capitalism. So you really have a minority of people who are extremely rich. There is no middle class. And then you have bunch of other majority who are really struggling to survive. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, and that's why people are falling back on, you know, remember the days mm-hmm. when I yep. was alive.
Yep.
We weren't in this situation. We pretty much everybody had the same, which is communist idea. To share, you know, if you have a lot, you share with somebody who doesn't have. And because at this point in today's society, you have extremely rich, extremely poor, no middle class, which is a beacon of each of every normal and prosperous society, right? And people are thinking about former Yugoslavia during the Tito days, mm-hmm. when they had that freedom, didn't miss anything. So it kind of go two ways. One, you have that ideology, do you live in a bubble or imagine in a world when you feel you don't miss anything, mm-hmm. right? And you step outside of that bubble, of that comfort zone, then you see a completely different world. But from that different world, you're only picking the negative things to justify why I'm living in a bubble.
Sure.
So, deep inside, I believe that, and I'm not going to be live, at some point in the future, this country will be forced to have some integration. Mm-hmm. I don't think they can survive individually as is, because they're right now, you know, all of them are struggling.
Okay.
And, you know, you can't compete. So that's why I'm thinking when people are talking about nostalgia about Yugoslavia, even on a Facebook, there is a, you know, page called Nostalgia about Yugoslavia. Uh-huh. And it's a lot of folks sharing experience about it, right? Mm-hmm. And how they lived and what they missed, what they didn't miss. So eventually, I'm thinking that in some future, there's going to be some type of integration, not to become as one country again, but, you know, some economic, social integration. Otherwise, I don't see them surviving in competition with the Germany and Western Europe and Russia. I think it's ludicrous. But again, to answer your question, which is a long-winded answer, yes, absolutely. There is a talk about it and people missing what they had. Not necessarily that if the society is different in the sense that is the governments are more conscious about their people instead of only thinking about their own wealth and that small percentage of really rich, mm-hmm. And thinking about the country. Let's take Montenegro. Montenegro is 650,000 people, right? Size of Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And you have an extremely rich the party which has been in charge for, I would say, 15, 16 years. They're winning all the time. There are corruptions. Everybody knows that, but nobody can do anything about it. Mm-hmm. And now NATO is being part of Montenegro, now being introduced to NATO as another member of alliance, which I see as a potential issue because of the Russia. Mm-hmm. Because Russia has always close ties with Montenegro. Serbia needed that access to Adriatic coast as well, which they are losing it if Montenegro is part of the NATO. Sure. So, yeah, so that's my take on it.
Very nice.
So there you go. That's Yugo nostalgia. And that does fit with what I've heard from pretty much everybody that I've asked about this. I mean, it's a bizarre phenomenon, and you know it would be weird to have Hitler backpacks and Pol Pot sugar packets, but somehow it's okay for Tito. And you know, it's not that people necessarily want to go back to Titoism, but it's like it's this whole pop culture scene. I mean, it's you can compare it to the Che Guevara t-shirts that you see in America or in the West. I mean, and you know, you think about that too, wearing one doesn't necessarily mean that you support the whole ideology that Che Guevara was for. I mean, you ask the average person who wears one, they probably don't even know. They're not even familiar with it, for that matter. But it just marks a certain feeling and a certain cultural scene. And in this case, it's a feeling of a sense of something lost, which, having just gone through an extremely traumatic war, I guess you can understand that sense of loss. And it's also about an older generation remembering their youth and maybe selectively recalling the good times and not so much the bad, which is what, you know, older people do pretty much all over the world. And they're always saying kids these days, right? Like they weren't utter terrors when they were young. Come on, right? I mean, it's a common phenomenon. But in this case, there is a name and a face to attach it to, and there's a whole industry that has sprung up around it. But you can also, at the same time, you can understand some actual wistful longing for those days, because in spite of Tito being a dictator and murdering tens of thousands of people, he did also bring stability, peace, and prosperity. And it was a time when everyone had a job, so long as you didn't piss off the regime, and you got several weeks of guaranteed vacation time, probably more than even I get today in America. And you could spend your vacations on the Adriatic coast, and often in your very own vikenda, as it was called. And that's borrowed straight from English weekend, just like it sounds, vikenda. And it's actually a cottage where you stay during your holidays. And many people in Tito's Yugoslavia had enough money that they could afford to build these things, and it was kind of a status symbol if you could. So, looking back on times like that, you can kind of understand a certain nostalgia. I mean, Tito's regime was by no means perfect, but looking back on it after a traumatizing war and a current era of division and uncertainty, it doesn't look all that bad. I guess that is, you know, at the root of this phenomenon called Yugo-nostalgia. Well, there you go. And that's it for our episode today, folks. Before we go, I do want to talk to Noah one more time. Noah, do you have any projects that you would like to plug as we take this episode out?
Sure. I'm doing a lot of things that are trying to essentially promote Slovenia abroad. I think I'm probably Slovenia's biggest cheerleader, at least in the Anglophone media. I'm always writing about it, and I have two books that just came out in June. One of them is about Slovenia's greatest artist, who's a modernist architect named Jože Plečnik. It was just published in a Slovene version and an English one. It's called Eternal Architect, The Life and Art of Jože Plečnik, Modernist Mystic. And it's a very beautifully illustrated book that tells the life and art of this extraordinary architect who anyone who visits Ljubljana falls in love with, the way anyone who visits Barcelona falls in love with Gaudi. The other one is a little more pop and fun, maybe. It's called Slovenology, Living and Traveling in the World's Greatest Country. It's a combination memoir, travelogue, and guidebook to Slovenia and my adventures here, and sort of explains what an interesting and fun place it is for foreigners. I think it's fun for foreigners who are curious about learning more about this exotic country, but it seems to be very popular in Slovenia too. The Slovene edition sold out very quickly because it shows an American's eye view of Slovenia and things that are everyday here that I highlight and think are exotic and unusual and fun and distinctive. And it's all very positive because I'm just built that way. I don't have a negative bone in my body. I just see the positive things in everything I do, which I'm sure is a defense mechanism, but there you go. It sounds a little bit funny that I would have a subtitle that Slovenia is the best country in the world, but I actually think that. I've lived in, I think, 8 different countries. And so out of those 8, if you look at the total package, quality of life, cost of living, safety, cleanliness, healthcare, education, natural beauty, ease of lifestyle, ease of travel, you name it, I don't think it gets any better than Slovenia. It's a very wonderful place to be.
Wow. Okay. Well, yeah, as a world traveler myself, I can say that that is very high praise for a country, and maybe someday I'll go there myself. It sounds pretty cool. Anyway, that's amazing. All right, thank you once again, Noah, for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Folks, you can check out Noah at his website, www.noacharney.smugmug.com. Meanwhile, if you like what we're doing here, why not support the show? You can contribute at www.patreon.com/deadideaspod. And if you do, $5 per month gets your portrait drawn in the time period and culture of your choosing. All right, we'll be back in 2 weeks for the final episode for now of this series on Titoism. And we will be interviewing Alex Cruikshanks, host of the History of Yugoslavia podcast. If you haven't checked it out yet, check it out. And Alex is going to talk to us about the national question, meaning the ethnic rivalries that have long plagued the Balkans Peninsula, which seemed to go away during Tito's regime, but which ultimately sprang back just as vivacious and ultimately led to the downfall of Yugoslavia. That's what we're going to be talking about next time for our final installment of Titoism. We'll see you then. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm BT Newberg, and this is Dead Ideas.